Hello, I'm Pia from Opinory, here to welcome you to the latest episode of OMR Media. And one more welcome to our German listeners. Hallo zu einer neuen Folge OMR Media. This is where we get insights on how publishers and audiences are changing through in-depth conversations with some of the smartest people in media. And this time we're talking with Lee Glendening, an executive editor at The Guardian, and her focus is getting more people to pay for Guardian journalism through memberships and donations of all sizes. This is going very well for The Guardian. Last year they announced that the number of financial supporters topped 1 million people worldwide. And we're excited to talk to Lee because finding new ways to fund top quality journalism is why we started Opinory. We began in Berlin and have helped leading German publishers engage, understand and convert their readers into loyal paying subscribers, and recently opened in London and New York. Now we're helping publishers around the world to start conversations with their readers, grow their audiences and revenues in ways that help their journalism reach more people and make more money. So let's get into our conversations with Guardian's Lee Glendening. Lee, welcome on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Before we jump into many questions that I have some first questions about you. You are Guardian's executive editor on memberships. And can you tell us how you came to that position and what exactly you're doing?
Sure. Yeah. I've been in this role for about the last 6 months. But I've worked for The Guardian now for more than 10 years, actually in lots of different parts of the world.
Australia, right?
Yeah. I am from Australia and I was part of the team that helped, the part of the founding team that launched Guardian Australia.
And when did Guardian
that
Australia
was launch? 2013.
Okay.
Yeah. And most recently before this role, I was in the States, as the editor of Guardian US. And before that I worked in the UK, as a reporter and editor, here in London.
Okay, so we have a very smart and media-savvy podcast audience, but for anyone who might not know, can you explain how Guardian is making direct user revenues and how your work on that exactly looks like?
Yeah, so that's a big question, especially at the moment. But I'm the editorial lead on membership and contributions, and this is something that we started to put a lot of energy around in 2015. So about 3.5 years ago now, we had a membership proposition that was mainly based around events. And we looked really closely at that, and thought about how we could deepen our relationship with our readers. And we had a real core component of our readership who were a part of that. I think it was about 12,000 people at the time. And we put a lot of energy into creating something that meant that we could really build a community of supporters. And so through Guardian membership, we looked carefully at what our readers wanted in that relationship and really examined how we could deepen the way we were talking to them and the way we were communicating with them every week. And I think one of the first key learnings we had was that our readers weren't really interested in tangible benefits. And so what mattered most to them was hearing about the journalism. At that time in 2015, I think we had about 150 million users and readers globally. Mm-hmm. But as you know, that was a time when the media landscape was in complete turmoil, and it was the moment when everybody first started to feel acutely that advertising revenues were going to Google.
And was the primary idea about it to build a more active and event-focused community, or was the primary idea how can we make more revenues or additional revenues with our large audience?
Different again. It was all about deepening our relationship with our readers, and so the idea of purely an events driven scheme turned much more into something that became about the purpose of the organization and the role we could play in the world today, but also at the same time, obviously, against a backdrop of acute financial pressure that media organizations were facing around the world. And so as everybody was looking for new business models or putting up paywalls or trying to figure out what the way forward was for them, we felt really strongly and keenly that we would need to look to our readers and we would need to figure out how our relationship with them could help us find the answer.
Did you ever consider paid content in that?
I think everybody's looked at different models over time. I think the key thing for us is that we didn't want to be part of a gated community. I think we wanted to find a way that we could keep our journalism open for people around the world, wherever they were and however they could access what we were doing. So we didn't ever want to do something that would prevent that happening. So that was sort of our starting basis. So if we thought, how do we keep this open for everybody wherever they are, and how can we deepen our relationship with our readers?
And then the price of the membership that you came up with, did it change over time, or was it always how much is it now again?
Well, it's the best way to think about what we're doing now is that we're saying to people, you can contribute what you would like to. So wherever you are and whatever you can afford. So people interpret that in all different ways. So we say from as little as a pound or a dollar or an Australian dollar, wherever you may be. Some people choose, one person, for example, says, well, I want to pay £365, £1 for every day of the year. Or people might choose to give us £5 a month or £20 a month.
What is the average contribution?
When people choose to give us a one-off contribution, it differs in different parts of the world, but it's somewhere in the vicinity of between £17 and £20.
Which is a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And then how did it change over time since the early days?
So one of the, so we went from sort of events into like formulating this idea of the purpose of The Guardian in this time. And our editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner, wrote an essay called A Mission for Journalism in a Time of Crisis this time last year. And so that really articulated our history, but also what we could take from history to where we were, where we are now. And that laid out for our readers and for our staff where we needed to be in a time that's challenging for everyone and all media organizations. But then in around April 2016, when we launched the big Panama Papers investigation, was the first time that we said to our readers, would you like to give a contribution to our journalism at an amount that you choose? And with membership and with contributions, we didn't know whether this was going to work. We were trying something out. We were asking readers for their support, and we were testing as we went along, but we weren't sure what was going to happen. And there was a lot of skepticism about this model from friends and competitors across the landscape. So it was we didn't have an answer. We looked to our readers to kind of...
And now, how is the split between ongoing monthly subscription revenues and one-time contributions?
It depends on which market you're talking about. So one of the really interesting things through this model is that because we're saying to our readers, you contribute the way you would like to. In America, for example, we see people choose to give a lot more one-off contributions, which fits culturally with how people want to give. In the UK, there's more recurring contributions. There's a deep level of membership. People have grown up with the paper, reading the paper and the brand. In Australia, we've got a really engaged audience who are very loyal. And then in Europe, there's lots of different variations from really generous giving in Scandinavia, for example, because culturally that's something that people are used to paying for news and believe in paying for news, to just different different ways of giving. And I think something that's felt really unique about this is the different support base around the world and how that has grown in the last 3 years. So when we started, obviously, it was predominantly a UK support base, but now we have really significant support in the States and in Europe and around the world. So That to me has been really striking, especially the voluntary.
Was it a strategic effort to expand your global impact and traction, or did it happen because of things that happened?
Both, but I think as it grew, we need to think really carefully about simple things in different markets, like payment methods that really make a massive difference in the States, or direct debit that makes a difference in other countries. So certainly improving those things over time meant that people could support us in their currency in the way that felt comfortable to them. But also because we had such a strong readership around the world, and we obviously have editions in Australia and America too, there was a natural support base there that this then allowed to grow.
And I guess that your strategic focus lies more on the recurring revenues and contributions than on the one-off.
Well, both, because I think when people choose to give one-off, they can often, they're moved by the journalism to decide which ways they want to give, and then their recurring relationship is someone choosing to commit.
That's my question. So do you have a conversion from one-off contributors to recurring contributors?
As in, do we have...
Like, is there a conversion of people who to contribute £10 and then turn into...
Yes, definitely. And I think that's part of the user journey. Sometimes we see that people will respond to a particular series of journalism, a particular article with a one-off contribution, but then over time they decide to have a deeper commitment and change that to a recurring contribution.
Can you see a pattern of... what kind of situations, events, or times drive unusually high numbers of contributions?
Yeah, I find this really interesting because I think a lot of news organizations, including us, have seen with really dramatic events in the world in 2016, the election of Donald Trump and Brexit, obviously people were giving around that time, and that drove significant levels of support. And I know, and obviously in subscriber models did the same thing, and I think there's been a lot of questions around whether that would continue. What I think we are seeing is a much more nuanced picture outside of those events and outside of only bad news. I think we see a lot of support for our environmental coverage. Stories about climate change drive a lot of, that's not really a positive example, but stories about climate change drive.
No, but I think it's where people see importance and impact.
Definitely. And we see a real pattern there. And I think that sort of speaks to the most meaningful journalism that you can do as well. I think what we see in what people want to contribute is towards, and the journalism that we're doing is the great issues of our time. People want to contribute money to support that kind of journalism, and so environment stories and that level of support, whether it be really bad news about climate change or extinction or report, the IPCC report, obviously recently terrible news, but also what we can do about that. So people do respond to articles about sustainability, reducing carbon footprints, the way we're eating, the way we're living, that kind of thing.
Rather in a problem-oriented sense or in...
Both. So this is some really bad news, and obviously there's been a lot of bad environmental news recently. But then there's the extension of that is, here's what you can do about it.
Yeah.
And these are some ways that you can start to think about living your life. I think as we all sort of take in this news and look for answers, that kind of journalism, has a really important place. So the other thing that we have seen is in our opinion pieces or our commentary, when people are looking again for meaning or sort of trying to understand what's going on in the world at the moment, I think those pieces can help, and people respond to those on an emotional level. Mm-hmm. And it's not all serious stuff either. I mean, it's sometimes there's a lot of nuance in what people are responding to. So, but the thing that I would say is common throughout this pattern is just meaningful.
What role does active contribution from members play? So how important is it that your paying members feel like having a say in and the coverage or being able to express themselves.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting part of all of this, because all of our readers who contact us a lot say that being involved in this to them is part of being in this community, and that's how we see it as well. And so the exchanges that we're having are very much about things that people are seeing and feeling wherever they are in the world, and we're communicating every week with people and readers about ideas and things that matter to them. And I think it's really important that we listen so carefully to that, and it can inform what we do and what we're thinking about. And there's the way that you would be thinking about prioritizing news dependent on the news agenda, like in any newsroom, and then there's what your readers are telling you about what matters to them. And I find it fascinating. I think there's so much we can learn.
We can see with our company Opinory that people who express their opinion have a much higher conversion rate into subscriptions, into newsletters, and are much more willing to respond to call to actions, and are because they feel like an active member, that their voice matters.
Yeah, and I think listening and belonging is a huge part of this. This is not a transactional relationship. It's about an exchange of ideas, and it's about believing in this kind of journalism.
Yeah. So how does your typical funnel look like from a user who clicks an article on Facebook till being a recurring paying member?
Well, there's so many different avenues, I think, that that our readers and supporters can go down depending on how they want to participate in the journalism, but also how they're consuming what we're doing. So it really depends whether you are going through reading on the app, or whether you are a print subscriber, or whether you are coming to the site every day. If you then choose to make voluntary contributions, then you will deepen your relationship with us and receive more communication from us each week, and then you can choose other avenues of that.
But then when you start with a Flybar user, how do you make this users download your app or come back tomorrow and the day after tomorrow? So how is your conversion? What are your conversion drivers along this loyalty journey?
Well, I would say the power of the journalism, but also there's so many different ways that people can engage in what we're doing. So whether that is participating in an article, or whether it is listening to a podcast, or whether it is reading the newsletter or signing up to more, like many of the different newsletters we're doing, or writing into us, any level of that is deepening their engagement with us. And because we're open for everybody, there's no insistence on payment to come to the site every day. So wherever you are in the world, you can be reading so many different parts of our journalism, or listening or watching, and you can decide if there's a time when you want to pay some money towards that. So some people say, I believe it's really important to pay for this because I want this website to remain open for everyone, and I can afford it where other people can't. And so that's why I want to pay. And we know from people who support us that is one of the key drivers in the reason why. That is something that's a really important motivation to keep the site open for everybody.
So you're striving towards 1 million paying members, right?
We've got that.
You've got that?
Yeah.
Ah, since when?
Last week.
Wow. That's exclusive news.
Well, we've just run a campaign on site over the last week to tell our supporters about this.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's big.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's an important milestone. It certainly felt like something for us that we really wanted to tell our supporters about, because at the beginning of all of this, like I keep saying, in 2015, a lot of our messaging and the way we were communicating with people was about advertising revenues are falling fast. This is really urgent. We need your help. And people responded to that. And now it's really important for us to say, this is how we're tracking, like this is how we're doing. It's going well. There's still a lot of work to do. There's still a long way to go. But you have responded, and now we need to talk about how we make this sustainable for the long term. Mm-hmm.
What's your churn rate?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you a number, but it's low. Mm-hmm. Because I think, because membership is something that has resonated deeply with our core readership, the people who have been there from the beginning, that has grown. So we don't see a lot of churn. I think in areas where, I guess, when you're thinking about churn with one-off contributions, obviously that's a completely, it doesn't fit, but people will choose when to give and how they want to maintain that. So that's different again. But the idea of how you move from help us in an urgent situation when the entire industry is in turmoil and we're almost going through a revolution to we've made progress and it's been really important. We couldn't have done it without you, but now we need to make this sustainable in the long term. So can you stay with us to do that? And can more of you come and be involved?
In this call to action to support and to make this sustainable, there are voices or people who experience this or who have labeled this as begging.
Mm.
And
initially,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about that?
I think that's part of the skepticism that we saw in the beginning. I think you know, it was definitely a risk, and we didn't know. Like I say, we didn't know how exactly how it would work, and I think everyone was looking for answers, and they still are. Everyone's looking for a sustainable business model in journalism, and asking and grappling with these questions. And so, yeah, those remarks were certainly.
Were you considering the opposite direction and giving users the idea that they can become a very exclusive member of this great club, like playing Soho House versus...
Were we or you were?
You.
Were
you considering that taking this more exclusive route versus addressing people's will to support independent journalism, for example, The Information, this Silicon Valley based media brand, which have is subscriber only with very high subscription fees, where they create a very exclusive community there.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you considering that route versus inclusive
for The Information and places like that? I can totally see why that works as a business model. I think for us, when we were founded in real social justice roots, I think we from the beginning wanted to find something that could keep the journalism open.
Yep.
And so that's what we were looking for, and we're looking for ways that we could maintain that. So that didn't feel like the way for us. But I can completely see why it's an interesting model and why it works for other loyal communities in different ways.
You wouldn't expect it from a brand like The Guardian. I wouldn't expect it.
Yeah.
No, because you are very I think your brand is very inclusive.
Yeah.
And purpose driven.
Yeah.
Where I would have been surprised, but I was wondering if you were considering it when in the first place.
Yeah.
But a week like last week, which was very confusing and news heavy from a Brexit perspective, what does it do to your contributions? And was it an accident that the 1 million were hit in that week?
Big news weeks do tend to drive contributions. I think for a number of reasons, obviously, there's more people on the site, things are changing and moving all the time. We're with a week like what we saw last week in British politics, we were covering that live every minute of the day. Things were changing all the time. And so you have more people than a usual day already accessing what you're doing and also using that to guide what's going on. I think people are looking for clarity and for answers and for trying to figure out what are the possibilities on the table here, what could possibly happen. So, those things tend to, and also I think, you know, you didn't know by the end of the week if we could possibly have a new prime minister, if there'd be a leadership challenge, what on earth could we have ended up. So I think at any time in news like that, it can be a big driver of contributions. But it just happened that last week was also the week that we were able to update our readers on because we obviously didn't know at the beginning of the week what was going to be happening in Westminster. So, but that I think was a really a different thing again, because it was us being able to update our supporters on what was happening with us and whether the business model was working. And it's amazing how important that was to let people know, because a lot of people were saying to us when we were talking to them, well, I'm contributing and I really want to be part of this, but what's going on? Like, is it working? Is it not? Mm-hmm. And of course,
so did you get a kidney stomp from them?
Did we what?
Get a candy storm.
A candy storm. Candies.
Versus shitstorm, like a storm of joy and...
Well, it was actually some really positive news. And as you know, there's not a lot around at the moment. And to actually be able to say, we have some really inspiring updates for you, it just proved that not only grim stuff can drive sort of a level of support. I think people really, really obviously want hopeful and good news and looking for a way forward on everything right now. So
I have one more general question, because I have some more questions about your work in that game. But on a general side, I think what everyone knows is at the bottom of the article, the section where you address users. I think it's at the bottom of every article, right?
It depends whether you are signed in.
Exactly. Yeah. But how is that standard element performing?
It's really, really important. Uh-huh. Because it's the space where we can tell the story of what we're doing. And it's a really important space because it feels like an extension of the journalism. And I think... when you've read something that's had an impact on you, whether it's made you think seriously about something or whether it's made you smile, all parts of the spectrum, you can be contemplating that and you are reading a short thing with us explaining why we need this support. And sometimes I think we haven't always got it right. I think when you set out to make a case for why you would want your readers to support you, you as a journalist may have certain ideas about what may resonate, and they are not necessarily what really drives people to give. And that to me has been such an interesting learning, because I think as an editor or a journalist, you could set out certain parts of this story that you would be, you know, reasonably sure you know how to tell a good story. But it's really not always the case that has been the things that have worked the most. So our messaging has definitely changed over time, and we're constantly iterating that. And it's...
What's the next step in messaging?
Well, because we're testing all the time, we work sort of in a really cross-disciplinary way, and we have lots of important... we have real UX research that goes into all of this that really informs what our readers are responding to. We have so many interviews with readers around the world that helps us understand why they might want to be involved.
Is there something where you clearly know that doesn't work at all with any audience and that is always
not
working?
Necessarily as much as that, but there's definitely things that resonate a lot more, and they wouldn't necessarily, you know, they can surprise you. I think, you know, we get really used to in newsrooms talking about paywalls or there's a certain level of terminology that you just are constantly using that people who are reading don't necessarily respond to those sorts of debates that feel theoretical to them, even though for us it's something that we're struggling with all the time to figure out how to do this. So I think things that are far more important about what we're doing is independence, mm-hmm. investigative journalism.
And that's your editorial side of this whole game. That's how does your day-to-day work look like there? So are you the one saying, we need a little bit more investigative stories now? Because
well, the great thing about this work is that we're all doing it together, and that there's lots of different levels of expertise in the room. So people are coming to it from an editorial point of view, from a commercial point of view, from a reader revenue point of view, from a UX, from marketing.
Yeah.
And I find it, I mean, it's very interesting on that mm-hmm. level, because you have lots of people feeding into how we can tell a compelling story.
And what are you doing all day?
Well, I mean, so many different things. As you know, with this work, it's very varied. But I think
you can take today, just today as an example.
Well, it's everything from communicating with our readers about what's happening in the newsroom, which is something that is really important to them to understand how we're coming to tell certain stories.
Are the users giving advices? Like,
No, I mean, certainly any reader would always be saying, oh, I'd love to read more on this or that. And, you know, there's always people that disagree with certain decisions or certain stories. And so I find, you know, you're always in a dialogue.
And what channels are you having these dialogues with your...
Email mostly. Email mostly. Then looking at where our support drivers are coming from, looking at that globally, figuring out what's happening in different countries, looking really closely at the stories that we're doing that are driving really significant support and understanding why. It's important for me to be the person that is communicating that to the newsroom as well, so people can understand what, if I'm the person in between the readers and...
Like, for example, what was the last important message that you brought into the newsroom?
Good question. Let me think. I'm trying to give you a really recent example. But the one that stands out probably over the last few months was... You remember when all of the boys from the soccer team were caught in the cave in Thailand. Mm-hmm. And that was a story that had captured the world's attention for sort of a 14-day span, and people were following it around the world. And we were covering it live across every time zone, so mm-hmm. we weren't stopping in how we were updating our readers on what was going on. And we started getting a lot of emails from people saying, this coverage is so compelling. I'm in California. I'm in India. I'm in Thailand. I'm in Sydney. I'm relying on this information to tell me what is going on in this story. And so, first of all, we started hearing it that way. So many emails from people saying, the factual information you're giving me here, I'm relying upon it. Please don't stop. Mm-hmm. And then we started seeing that data coming through in the stories that people wanted to contribute to as well. And so obviously that was an incredibly emotional story too. Everybody wanted the right thing to happen. Mm-hmm. And we're desperately hoping for good news, which is what happened. But so on many different levels, we started seeing a response to this story that, that was significant in terms of, how people felt they needed the journalism, how they felt they wanted to be updated, how our correspondents around the world were able to do that, and then what they felt that they wanted to contribute to financially to support that kind of journalism. So that's an example from, you know, over the last couple of months of something that really stood out to me that was not Brexit, was not Trump, was not politics, but a human story that people were gripped by. That they trusted our journalism on. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily something that you would have predicted, I think.
What publisher or non-publisher examples in the membership world are you looking up to or seeing as very good examples where memberships models work very well?
That's a good question. Because I think the interesting thing about this landscape, as you would know, is that everyone's at these really different stages of what they're doing. Obviously, Day Correspondent was involved in this from a long years ago, a few years ago now. And I think the way that they have created that and the journalism that they have done because of it has been really inspiring to break the mold and think about how your readers can inform what you're doing.
And maybe, but publisher unrelated, outside of publishing, you are, Netflix is a membership.
Yeah.
Spotify.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, when you think about what we as consumers decide to give money to every month, it's completely different to what it would have been 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And we feel very strongly towards those things and very loyal towards them. And those Spotify, Netflix, etc., are things that are very much in our daily lives now. And so there are definite learnings from how you go from being a traditional newsroom, to a place where readers and supporters would consider your existence so vital in the way that they want you in their lives every day and every week. And I think Netflix and Spotify and other organizations like that, Amazon, have created that in the last.
Is there some other takeaways in that that you copy or adapt?
I can't think of an example of where we have with those. I think I'm more interested in the theoretical side of their business model and mm-hmm. how we've gone from not relying on it to being incredibly reliant on it. I think things around payment flows and frictionless payments and how you can make it so easy for people on their phone to be supporting you mm-hmm. that are really interesting learnings in that sphere. And mm-hmm. I think
and different expectations from users. Yeah. They just don't tolerate this awful user journeys.
Yeah, and I think sort of a level of sophistication there. Yeah. There's some really interesting work of how you make things frictionless and quick and easy for people in that area. But it is, you know, it's one thing to start, from, you know, creating something like that from the ground up. It's another to be working in a, 200-year-old almost news organization and how you can transform part of that to have a reader revenue model that is such a predominant part of your revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So to turn these 1 million into 10 million now,
yeah.
What are the big next steps that are planned?
Well,
product, technological or editorial or marketing side?
At the moment, we are working to break even in April 2019, and that is our immediate goal. And
April 2019?
Yeah, soon.
5 months.
I know.
Wow.
I know.
Uh-huh.
So
how close are you?
Well, it's not an easy thing to do. It's really challenging. And especially, I don't think anyone could say the landscape we're working in right now is easy in terms of business model.
We just turned cash flow positive.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're working to the, April 2019 break even. And then, what we're looking to do is create a sustainable situation where we can continue to do brilliant journalism through the support of our readers. And there's various steps along the way to get there, but obviously the million was a really key moment in that.
So congratulations to that, and we are very excited to follow the next steps.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
Thanks for coming in. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks for sharing all these interesting insights. Danke fürs Zuhören. Thanks for listening. If you want to turn more of your readers into paid subscribers, or if you just want your readers to be more loyal, Opinory can help. Get in touch with us through our site, which is opinory.com. That's opinary.com. That's all for the OMR Media podcast for now. Please subscribe and listen to our other recent conversations and share and review our podcast if you like it. I'm Pia Fey. Talk to you next time.